Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Hey guys, tonight we're going to talk about Steven Soderbergh's The Informant, sort of a biopic based on a true story-ish thing about a biochemist turned business executive of a food conglomerate corporation in the mid-90s. That's when it starts, and then it kind of takes about 8 years to get all the way through. Yes. So, and The Informant. Pretty much... I didn't know anything about this actual story. Did you know anything about this actual story, or how much of it
read
true?
The particulars before. Well, that's the thing, is that it doesn't really matter what's true or not, because it's so much of it is filtered through him and his narration.
Yeah,
and that's what this thing is. It's kind of hard to talk about this without spoiling it too, because it's not a spoiler if it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe the plot turned like that.
Yeah,
but it's about someone who's a pathological something. I didn't just give it away.
No, I don't think you did.
He could be a pathological sex addict.
Yes, that could be possible. Have they done a good movie about sex addicts?
The Tiger Woods biography.
The Lifetime original movie, right? Yeah.
Tiger's insatiable hunger.
Uh-huh. Tiger, burning bright.
He's burning somewhere, probably.
Oh, boy.
You know, I heard he likes to go weapons-free on women.
What does that even mean?
It's a phrase I came up with. I invented this, by the way. Coined phrase, copyright 2010, Zach Nuker. The weapons-free refers to not wearing condoms. You go weapons-free on a chick, that means you just basically went bareback.
Uh-huh.
You hit it raw.
Okay.
Raw and dirty.
Okay.
You listened to enough rap back in the day, you understand what that means, right?
Raw and dirty?
Hitting something raw.
It means no condom, right?
Exactly.
Okay. It's pretty simple.
Okay. But yeah, you went weapons-free.
Oh, wow.
That's what they say.
That's what they say.
The consensus of all the women... all the women polled.
Mm-hmm. All polled?
They were polled.
Yeah.
By the census. The census now officially is on wing for just Tiger Woods.
Oh, wow.
Conquests. And they were polled.
It's
and
part of
they said
the stimulus, huh?
Yeah, exactly. There was a stimulus package involved. and it was a multi-ethnic stimulus package.
Of course.
It turns out they say...
No child left behind.
He liked to demand that... No sort of prophylactics were involved
required.
In the process.
So would he just like soak like a rag with bleach and cram it up there first? Or how did he ensure that he wasn't getting baby mamas?
That wouldn't feel good for you either afterwards, I don't think.
No, I don't think it would.
Getting some residuals.
Yeah, you're definitely going to get the residuals.
Unless you let her soak it up for a good few hours.
Yeah, a couple at least.
Before we meet up tonight, I'm going to have to pour a bunch of bleach into you.
Mm-hmm. Or like brandy or something. I don't know, whatever would work.
Brand? You brand her?
Brandy.
Tiger Woods. So
wow.
What happens to the informant?
The informant is basically...
Here's what I thought.
It's kind of tough. Like you said, without the spoilers, it is kind of like, what?
So this guy... gosh, what was his name?
Dr. Biochemist. That to me, that always fascinated me. While you're looking that up, I'll mention this.
Whitaker?
The idea that, like, people with... professional level degrees that require a lot of discipline and a lot of intellect can still have like just completely fuck up their lives. It always seems strange to me. Doesn't it seem strange to you? Like, cause like I've been to college, you know, I was a pre-med for a while. I know some of what it would take to actually become a physician. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of discipline. It's a lot of not hanging out with your friends and not doing fun things and, you know, reading and thinking and implementing things and staying up late and all this stuff. I mean, especially to get a degree in the sciences. And this guy has that. This guy's got like a PhD in biochemistry. He's not really a business guy, but then he still ends up becoming, he has all these problems. That's almost the most fascinating part to me about it is how does this happen? How do people end up this way? I guess it just goes to show that success in one aspect of life does not necessarily mean the person is not without their issues or failings.
So here's how it starts. Damon is a high-ranking executive in this company
mm-hmm.
at this point when it starts in the early 90s, whatever. And he
I've seen it more recently.
The thing starts where he tells his bosses that he has been. They're trying to shake him down.
The Japanese. The Japanese are shaking him down. Yeah.
For something. And so they tell him to get the FBI involved.
They've been putting a virus in some chemical that they're trying. Yeah, in their lysine. Something like that
for the corn, whatever. Mm-hmm. So he gets the FBI involved. And then when the FBI gets involved, he tells him at that point.
Yeah, eventually.
I was lying, and here's why. Because.
No, he doesn't tell him that he was lying about that. That's way into it. Right. That comes out that was all crap.
But something else comes out in him talking to the FBI, which in that case, I think is Scott Bakula.
It's Bakula.
And another thing that's interesting about this, just cast wise, is a lot of comedians play utterly straight roles.
Bakula? Utterly straight roles. Bakula's not a comedian, but he's
Joel McHale.
Joel McHale. Patton Oswalt is in it.
Yeah, what's his name?
I know that the guy from Mr. Show, Fred Tompkins or Paul Tompkins is in it towards the end.
Tony Hale from
from Arrested Development's in it. Yeah, it's weird. It's
Tommy Smothers and Dick Smothers are in it.
Yeah, the Smothers brothers are both in it. One is a judge, and the other I forget what he is. But
so anyway, it's just interesting because what was weird to me was I watched it with Kristen. And it's not the kind of movie she would have liked.
Yeah.
But about 15 or 20 minutes into it... Well, so first of all, as the movie's kind of going along, pretty much as a straightforward drama, you've got this really bouncy, jaunty Marvin Hamlisch score.
Yeah, I love that.
Which is
it's such a throwback to the 70s.
And then, all of a sudden, his narrations get weirder and weirder. Because he narrates in between scenes.
Yeah.
And the narrations basically just become non sequitur mentions of facts that sound utterly outlandish and completely unrelated to what's happening.
Yep.
And they start to get funnier and funnier. And at that point, you're like, man, this is getting weird. I like this. As it goes on, he's prone to grandiosity, maybe. And
delusions of grandeur.
Yeah, and it ends up being about price fixing.
Yeah.
And what's funny is... This is almost impossible to go spoiler free on this.
But
what's funny is they pretty much weren't price fixing until he kind of pushes them to price fix and makes them pretty much come out with their price fixing. And when what's funny is that if you notice, he mentions
when they're recording, they're like,
yeah, I guess we can do that, sure. And then they meet and they're like, how can we never met before like this? And he's very carefully hiding the cameras and mics and stuff. And meanwhile, all the people are like, gosh, thanks for setting all this up for us. This is a great idea. We really should do this more often. He basically makes everyone commit more crimes than they would have otherwise.
Yeah.
And that's funny because I don't know. Anyway, the character ends up being utterly fascinating.
Yeah.
And this is even one of the major spoilers, but this doesn't pertain to the plot. Even his hair ends up being fake at the end of it. That's how ridiculous this character is, and how his whole life is built on just falsehoods, which is interesting because he has a lot of money already. He could have got away with.
He was smart.
Anything he was doing.
He just was weird.
He was smart, but he was bipolar and all this stuff. And I don't know. I just thought it was a brilliant. Damon was really good for the role, I think, because he has a real. Just as an actor, he's very eager and very forthright.
Which is why I think he's always it's weird in the Bourne movies because it's I think that's the most divergent of roles for Damon.
Probably, I mean, it worked well in Talented Mr. Ripley. It works well in Good Will Hunting. I mean, anything he's in for the most part, he's playing someone who's very forthright and eager, and he's generally not deceptive. And he's trying to when he talks to someone, he's really already trying to convince them, and you can tell that.
Yeah.
So he was perfect for this role.
Yeah, the guy that's trying to get away with something, but knows he's trying to kind of get away with it, and kind of doesn't feel okay.
And it seems he's just trying to get away with something really stupid, and then it turns out he's not. and then
your sympathies totally change too.
It does. And what's funny is that it's got a little bit of the bromance thing in it because the one thing that really bothers parties involved is that
he thinks that he's going to be taking over, but he's not.
Well, not just that. It's the Bakula thing.
Yeah.
Like we're becoming friends. Mm-hmm. He becomes friends with Bakula, and of course his investigation. And then Bakula feels personally betrayed, and that's transferred to Damon as like, you know, we're not friends anymore. And he's like, oh my gosh, like, oh, what can I do to fix this and make people not mad at me anymore? And there was a little bit of did you ever see Shattered Glass?
I've seen parts of it.
You've got to see that movie. Yeah. It's very good, and it's worth seeing despite Hayden Christensen mm-hmm. being the main character in it. It's got something similar to that in that the main character is not only, you know, whatever is wrong with him, but he's so eager for people to approve of what he's doing, not even to be liked because people like him already, but to approve of what he's doing. And like if the interesting thing about Shattered Glass is, after every single thing he gets caught doing, he asks the person, "Are you mad at me?" Like an 8-year-old would, and more and more they keep looking at him like, "Am I mad at you? Like why would that even matter?"
Yeah.
And Peter Sarsgaard is really good in it. I highly recommend that one.
Yeah, you mentioned it a few times.
And that had a similarity to this movie, I felt like. So I kind of link the two when I think about him. Though Shattered Glass wasn't funny, you know, it's just a straight up drama. Very interesting movie. I think it might be a little bit better than The Informant. But The Informant was, like you said, you know, it's more of a comedy. I also felt that the filming style had a little bit of the Barbara Walters filter in it, and it made it look like it was much older.
It did.
Than even the 90s.
Yeah, it did. It almost did feel very.
It made it feel like it was like the 70s almost.
Well, the Hamlisch score and the filters, yes.
So
and the color scheme.
Kind of a weird idea of like where to go with it production wise. Like, you know, I didn't know about that, but I mean, I ended up enjoying it. And the funny thing was, Kristen laughed. Like, there were some parts where she laughed, and generally those movies where we walk out and she's like, "That was such a stupid movie" afterwards, but like, you know, I hear her laughing all the way through it, I know she enjoyed it.
She just doesn't want to admit it.
Yeah, so I thought that was pretty good, and I don't remember what I rated it, but I want to say I gave it like 3.5 out of 5 or 3 out of 5, something like that.
Yeah, I'd give it a 3.5. I'd give it a 3.5 because any movie that can pull the whole "I'm on this guy's side, now I'm not on this guy's side" switcheroo on me as this does.
I don't think you're ever not on his side though.
By the end, I'm just kind of sick of it. You know, I'm with Bakula kind of by the end. I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, I'm done with you. I mean, whatever, buddy. Why? I'm still so the whole time sort of baffled, like, biochemist, really? That's hard. Why would you, how can you be this crazy and weird and stupid and be that smart? Right. It doesn't make any sense. I glorify people like that. My inferiority complex knows no bounds. Anyone that's good at stuff that I'm not good at, I think, is immediately more well put together. That's a terrible mistake that will no doubt come back to haunt me at some point, right?
Right.
Indeed.
Terrible mistake.
Yeah, so yeah, 3.5 for me on The Informant. I would say, not a weakness to it, but Soderbergh kind of stays out of the way of the movie, I think. You know, not that he has...
He's always done that.
Not that he's particularly... has a particular autism. Not that he's particularly, like, I don't know, there's no real Soderbergh-type shots or anything that I can think of offhand,
right,
looking at his whole canon. But, well, he doesn't have the gimmick of time like he does in The Limey or in Girlfriend Experience, you know, where he just kind of just takes everything out of chronological order and puts it all over the place, and which he could have done in this movie if he wanted to.
He definitely likes chunking stuff together in like different parts, like in traffic and things like that.
Yeah.
And, the thing is, I think he's one of the people always forget about him, but he is one of the better directors alive today because he can do any genre. He can completely change his directorial style for anything, and he can go dreamy and weird and like. Out of Sight is so stylistically brilliant.
Yeah.
It's stylistically almost overwhelming, but in a positive way. And it's just fantastic. And the only thing I think he made that came close to that, like in that style, was The Limey, but it's in a totally different direction. Because that has a lot of like
the Ocean's films. I think the Ocean's films match that style of Out of Sight.
I felt like they were way more straightforward. Like and also with their more comedic thing. The Out of Sight, like anything that's an Elmore Leonard has its own kind of style to it.
Yeah,
because it's instead of being,
you're talking about like color filters and stuff.
No.
Because The Limey, I remember
about,
being
I'm
very
about
filter
his,
heavy.
His dissolves and his his use of background sound from another scene that's already ended or you haven't come to yet while something is still happening.
You're right, you're right. Those two are definitely more related.
Exactly. I mean, in Lyme, he keeps going to the beach where he find, you know, where he does that thing at the end. And he uses that sound like through a lot of the movie, like, because it's kind of also cutting back and forth in time a little bit. But I don't know, you know, he's
Have you seen King of the Hill yet?
I've seen bits and pieces of it.
It's got a lot of that in it. I mean, it's got a lot of the dissolves. And
he's just excellent. I'm not going to watch, you know, Shay or anything like that. But,
or part one or two, yeah. I don't think I'm interested in that either. But, no, I would say, yeah, he's very... he's a good director, just solid, reliable. I mean, I'm always interested to hear what he's doing. I don't necessarily think I'll see everything he does or care about everything he does.
I agree with that, but I also have to say I think he's much better than just good. I think he's probably one of the top five.
Oh yeah, that's what I mean. I wouldn't care otherwise. You know, I think I only really
he has the added thing about being nominated multiple times. He's won. You know, he's won Best Picture.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff. So
that's always solid. Yeah. That'll do you a number. Okay, so yeah, 3.5 for The Informant. Our review of it was a little all over the place and a little schizophrenic and a little bipolar, but that kind of matches the tone and the theme of the movie. If you're into sort of... if you're into comedies with levity and a sense of... Well, comedies with the... It's more like if you're into suspense movies with like a sense of levity and comedy, or comedy with a sense of suspense... Or I don't know how to put it, because there's a little bit of that. It's a little bit of like the insider in it.
That's
you know
the thing
what I mean?
He's able to do is he's able to. There's a little bit of that, and I think that's. I mean, even the name is like a play on that, though. He didn't write the name; it's the name of the book. He's able to put comedy into a completely real world, as weird as it seems. Like, this world seems weird.
Oh, yeah.
Because of him, because of his character.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife's kind of dumb. And a lot of the, like, the people who work at his building are just stupid. Like, the other bosses.
Tom Papa, another comedian.
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah. You know, they're just, like, really dumb for the most part. And then there's the FBI who are just, like, they're just, like, almost exasperated by how stupid a lot of these people are.
Yeah.
And they're constantly saying things like that. And then Tony Hale character is, like... You gotta be kidding me. Like he keeps changing the numbers when he tells him.
Uh-huh.
And he's like,
yeah.
Is that it? Like,
is that it?
Like, I don't know. But he's able to put that in an utterly weird, real world. And in most comedies, doesn't exist. You know, here's something I've been watching a lot, just because it ends up being on TV a bunch of times, that every time I see it, I appreciate it more and more. I don't know if you've ever seen this movie or if you liked it at all, but Saving Silverman.
I've seen it. Yeah, I sat and watched it once.
Actually a really good comedy, and I hated it the first time I saw it. I was like, this is some... PG-13 junk, but it is any other PG-13 comedy ever made. Like, there's a stigma attached to PG-13 mm-hmm. comedy. Either got Rob Schneider, Derpy Dirk.
Mm-hmm.
You got the Adam Sandler thing, which quickly devolved into the bad Adam Sandler thing.
Mm-hmm.
there's only so much, and it's almost all Saturday Night Live stuff. Like, there's not a lot of PG-13.
There's comedy lot of absurdism in the whole
exactly.
thing. Yeah.
So, Saving Silverman though is weird to the point where it's like it's in no way in a real world, and it's utterly ludicrous. And to the point where they break the coach out of jail at one point, and nothing ever comes of that.
Yeah,
he breaks them out of jail. He smashes their truck in the jail cell, and he goes, "Come on, boys!" And they jump.
And then Neil Diamond's
like
in the
a
back.
Tommy gun.
Yeah.
Well, no, yeah. Then they go and kidnap Neil Diamond, which is really easy. Also, they don't show that. They just suddenly throw someone. They run into a building, and they come out holding a bag, and it's Neil Diamond. But that has. Fantastic dialogue, like some of the better dialogue jokes, and it's a really wonderful use of Jack Black.
Well, and Steve Zahn's in that too,
Steve
right?
Steve Zahn is great.
And those characters are kind of
and they work
part,
really well together. And you don't like the main character. I don't like Jason Biggs anyway, and you're not really supposed to. I think it's kind of about the JT and Wayne mm-hmm. or whatever names are. But there's some great lines where like Wayne will say something where, like they're driving in the car and he's like, "There's only one thing we have to do right now," and Jack Black's like. Yeah, and he goes, "We gotta kidnap, his fiance," and he goes, "Yeah," and there's a long pause, and he goes, "What?" Like, like there's a lot of there's like moments like that, like you know, and what's funny is that I was directed by the guy who directs all of them, Dennis Dugan, who directed Happy Gilmore, and he's basically a go to guy for the garbage PG-13 comedies,
okay,
but like I don't know, like. I really think that's kind of severely underrated comedy. Like, mm-hmm. these days, comedy, like, the market for comedy is so depleted. Any comedy comes out now, and you almost have to see it. Like, anything that's not a romantic comedy, because romantic comedy kind of dominates that, and that's a totally different genre, in my opinion. You would know, you've been writing one.
I've been writing one. I don't know if that's what it's going to be. I don't know. It's going to be different. It's going to... Well, it's going to be more of a... I think already...
Is it a teen sex comedy?
No, it's going to be more of a... of like a David Gordon Green like type of movie, maybe. I think then you know what, I don't know, I need to actually see more of his movies, I think, but it's gonna be more like
just, the rest of his movies aren't funny,
but that's what I mean, it hasn't really had a lot of humor in it, but it's had situational humor.
So it's a romantic it. Drama,
it's not even really that
it's
romantic.
Like that one with Piper Perabo where she finds out she's a lesbian.
Oh, I'd like to see that.
It's not good. Oh. It's really boring because it's not funny.
Is it sexy?
No.
Damn.
It's PG-13.
Oh.
It's as sexy... It's
as sexy as PG-13.
It's as sexy as PG-13 will allow you with lesbians, which is, I think, they kiss once.
Oh, boy. No, it's... I don't know what it's going to be yet. I'm just... Right now, I'm just struggling getting the, like, nuts and bolts together, and then I think I'll have to go back and take a second pass to try to put more... I'll have to have you read it.
You should get 900 bucks together and send it to those porn guys.
Yeah, right.
Make this romantic.
There's kids and stuff in it. I mean, like,
they'll probably just go ahead and bang. If they realize it was romantic, they'd see the word romance, be like, well, I guess we can go ahead and throw sex.
And now we'll bang. Bang it in the biology classroom.
Let's in this same thing, since we're in the kind of somewhat comedic, though, in a dark way.
Sure.
Thing, let's go to this Serious Man.
Serious Man. Okay, doubling down, double podcast. Here we go.
Doubling down.
So, A Serious Man, directed by the Coen brothers.
Black.
What?
I threw a little Passenger 57 in there.
Just for the hell of it?
Yeah. Oh, because you said double down. I thought I'd throw another gambling
reference.
In there.
Okay.
Always bet on black.
Buy low and sell high, huh?
The, I've been pressured to write Wesley Snipes into that Legionnaire script that I've been writing for the producer and Luke. And Luke, almost every other email sends me something. Make sure you put a line in there about the Wesley Snipes character saying, always bet on black. And I'm like, okay.
Roy, have you seen From Paris with Love yet? With the
no,
Royale with
Cheese? If I was going to see anything last week, it would have been that. But I heard it. Here's the thing. I think it was directed by the guy who did Transporter 2.
Oh, wow.
So I probably should have
It was directed by the guy who did Taken. That's what
that's right. That's right.
For,
the Taken. Yeah. Pierre Morel. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's part of the... I read a funny review that was like, this is the latest. And they're now calling everything Luc Besson produces, like... Like the worst kind of Euro trash, uh-huh. but like in a fun way, you uh-huh. know. Like, what's funny is, but he's made some pretty like decently critically acclaimed stuff. Like people like Fifth Element,
mm-hmm.
and people, you know, love Leon the Professional, and now it's like
and La Femme Nikita. Those are his three movies,
well,
as far as I know.
And
then he did The Messenger, and I don't know if that was like maybe
no. And then he did Boiling Point, or not Boiling Point, but A Point of No Return, which is a remake of La Femme Nikita,
okay,
for
yeah.
American Market.
He did that.
He did that one, yeah.
Okay.
And anyway, like at this point, it's like. He just decided, you know, I can make so much money having a stable of decent directors make this just trash, where basically we have Americans come to Europe and destroy Europe while ripping on Europe, and we'll make a bunch of money in America because that's what matters. That's what's funny to me, because mm-hmm. they're all French. All the filmmakers and producers and stuff and writers are French, and every single movie is like... Paris is the worst pit of, you know.
The denizen of Eastern Euro trash.
Once the
Iron
Don't curtain, come to Europe. We're going to rape and kill you and take your money.
Once the Iron Curtain fell, right?
Yeah, then Paris became the new...
That's too bad.
The new...
That's too bad, because I really liked Fifth Element. I really enjoyed that movie.
That's not too bad. It's good.
Well, it's fun.
You like the Transporter movies?
The Transporter movies, I can give
Where's
a pass
Where's your brother?
To.
Your brother needs to be here to defend
Slap
this
me
with
around,
me.
Right? No, I don't know.
You've seen Transporter 2, right?
I've seen
You've seen all
I saw all of Transporter 2, I've seen all of Transporter 3, and I've seen most of Transporter 1.
You haven't seen all of Transporter 1?
No.
Transporter 1 has one of those bad guys who, even if he didn't do anything evil in it, just the way he looks would be evil enough for him to deserve death.
A terrible death where he covers his face for no
and
reason.
And he has the little Caesar haircut,
like
George Clooney did for a while.
1994.
Where like it kind of like grows a little longer toward the sideburns, and he always glares down at people like this. He looks around like this. He kind of stands there like an anime bad guy the whole film, like this, like glaring at people.
Is he drinking red wine?
No, he doesn't drink ever. He just stands there. He goes like this. He's great.
Oh my gosh.
He deserves death, for
the
sure.
The eyebrow look up makes him deserve death.
You've probably seen this part, but
the missile.
Statham's able to open his window and see a missile coming and go run inside, grab the girl, get inside a pulley, close the door, and then go down before the missile hits.
I know.
That was great. I couldn't even walk to your stairs. Like, I couldn't even get up out of this chair by the time someone shot a missile from how far that was.
I don't think that.
I couldn't get out of this chair.
And then you'd be dead.
A missile!
You'd be like, I'm back! Okay, so a serious man. No.
Yeah.
I lost a dollar in a bet to my brother about the serious man.
I just lost a dollar to myself.
Oh.
Okay.
You
lost a... okay, what was the bet?
The bet was that... remember the third rabbi, Morvish or whatever? Yeah. I don't know if this is really a spoiler. It doesn't really matter. But remember how Five-ish Finkel's in the beginning? And you're like, yeah, put picket fences. Woohoo! Mm-hmm. Return to Five-ish Finkel. And I was like, that third rabbi is going to be Five-ish Finkel. Like, they're just going to do that. Just to make an extra level of strange. Enough. I thought they might not, but I thought they might too. And so it's like a dollar. Here's the thing, though. I had this extra confidence because I always...
You doubled down?
I always fast forward through the ends of movies when we're watching them together because I love me a good secret ending. And they're almost never there. And Seth just gets so infuriated by the extra 10 seconds.
Why didn't he just get up and leave?
I don't know. He just does. So anyway, the last time I did it was when we were watching Saw 6. And he's like, $10. $10 is no secret ending. There's never secret endings, Ian. And I'm like, 1 out of 10, it's like a secret ending. You know? He's like, $10. He's like, $200. Apparently he said $200. I get to the very end and boom, secret ending in Saw 6. And I'm like, there you go. And he's like, you could have got $200. And I'm like, no, I never bet. I never, ever, ever bet. And then with the Five-ish Finkel, I was like, no. Oh, that would be right in this weird
movie.
So
you bet this time. Uh-huh. See, you took a bad beat before. You never bet after a bad beat.
I know.
You gotta walk away.
You gotta walk away. But I thought for a dollar,
you gotta stand
whatever.
Up and go smoke a few.
I was also feeling like I was just empathizing with this character enough that I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna invite more self-pity on myself and just take a losing bet here.
So what did you think of it?
I liked it. I built it up really high in my mind because I've got such a sort of nostalgic love for Barton Fink because...
It's different than that.
It is, but
the Jewishness isn't as much as an influence.
No.
This is 100% about being a Jew.
But it's more just the nature of the way the story is. For me, when I really fell in love with these certain kind of movies when I was in middle junior in high school or something, and I would get home and no one would be home, and on Fridays they would do IFC preview. On Bravo before NBC bought them, and they'd show like La Femme Nikita and The Big Picture and and for Barton Fink, and I just started watching it and I was like, this is cool. And that's when I saw King of the Hill, I mean, movies like that, and I like all of those movies, and I like the way that they tell stories, the kind of characters in them, and the bizarreness of it. And so I think that was one of the only Coen movies that I always felt like Barton Fink kind of stood out as its own thing in the Coen canon. Usually it seems like they've got like three or four kinds of ways they can do a movie. You know, they've got the No Country for Old Men, very serious kind of thing, but it's also still got elements of humor. They've got, I mean, in that same sort of realm, they've got like Miller's Crossing, which I think is a little more comedic, and just because it's a period movie and it's more bizarre.
I think that's one of their less
Miller's,
comedic
Miller's
films.
Crossing?
Yeah.
The part where with the Tommy gun and Albert Finney is not funny to you?
I think it's awesome.
It's awesome, but it's funny too.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that's one of their least funny movies.
It is definitely one of their
least
funny
movies. I think
Barton
Fink is probably funnier than that.
Oh yeah, definitely. But I have been waiting for another, like, I don't know, I hate to say, how to say it, but like a quiet, weird Coen movie. The Man Who Wasn't There was, I guess, the last one they did like that, and I enjoyed
that. People
love
that, and I didn't like it.
It is what it is.
I thought it went off the rails at the end.
It does go off the rails in the end, literally and figuratively. I'll give you that. But for the most part, I enjoyed it. I think I like Billy Bob. I just thought he did a good job with that role. Anyway, so that was my anticipation. That was what I was going into with this. I'd heard a few reviews, and. It sounded like, okay, this is what it's about. It's just, it's about a guy that's just going to, have to deal with some crap. And I kind of like those weird, kick the little guy and see what happens movies. And yeah, I think I enjoyed it. I mean, it doesn't have like a closure. It doesn't have like a heroic, win at the end. Neither does Barton.
It does have a closure at the end, though, because here's the thing. And this is impossible to talk about without spoilers also. But first of all, so...
The opening is very strange.
The opening is super strange, and it has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, Seth kept asking that. And what's this going to have to do? What's the end?
No, that's the thing, is that they've said in interviews that has nothing to do with anything. We just wanted to put that in there.
Yeah.
And people are like, really? And also, what's funny is one interviewer asked them, they also were like, you know, I thought it was really funny that you made a big emphasis on the parable of the goy's teeth, mm-hmm. when that really had nothing to do with anything also. And they're like, yeah, I'm glad you noticed that.
Because it has nothing to do with anything. Because none of this has anything to do with anything.
But that's the point. It's not just that.
It's almost an anti-Semitic movie in the way that it's like, all this Jewish stuff and says, you know what?
Here's the thing.
Because he lives by that, and he thinks that makes him a good person. And in the end, following all of those things.
The thing is, he is not a good thing. He hasn't followed the faith that closely.
Yeah.
When troubles start coming in, he decides to go back to the faith, which is the thing people fall into. So he goes. He talks to a series of rabbis. He experiences more and more weirdness in his life. And the strange thing is the weirdness that happens in his life, and I thought this was the best thing, is stuff that everyone deals with.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely 100% universal.
But how he deals
with it. His neighbor has had a dispute about his property.
Yeah.
He starts having weird feelings about his neighbor. His wife decides to leave him. His kids are, you know, one of them smokes pot, one of them is stealing money. You know, like,
they're alienated, indignant, exactly. And they're jerks.
But he takes this like such an affront from God. God, why are you doing this to me? What have I done? He can't understand why these things that happen to everyone else. And that's, I think, the joke about the Jewishness,
mm-hmm.
is he's like, oh my gosh. Why, you know, like, yeah. he's overreacting.
It's definitely got elements of, I would say, even though I like the movie, it has parts that are like the worst episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm, where it's like he's letting this happen to himself, or this scenario is so contrived. Like, that he would pay for that guy's funeral, yeah. makes no sense. It's hilarious.
He felt guilty.
But based on what?
Because of his wife. He's pushed around by his wife. That's the Jewish thing.
I guess. It's the Jewish thing. It just doesn't make... But it's not even his wife. She's already shit-canned him. And just the way she treats him. It doesn't matter. He's
still... But you realize how he still bends over backwards for her?
Yeah.
So, this is what I thought was brilliant about it. So I thought was brilliant about it. He keeps claiming to everyone, I haven't done anything. I've done nothing.
And I'm not an evil man.
Yeah. Well, here I think is the point. I mean, you've heard the quote before about how the evil man is the one who does nothing.
Like, exactly. Gandhi said that.
Like, he hasn't done anything, but he had completely... He's going to his faith for answers as to why these unfair things have happened to him, and he keeps saying, I've done nothing, but he's also done nothing for his faith or you know, to feed his faith. He's not even part of his faith. He doesn't have any faith in anything. And so I think what happens at the very end, without giving away spoilers... is, you know, to him, with the phone call,
yeah,
is a completely 100% a direct correlation to him taking the envelope and doing what he does with the envelope at the end. You agree with that?
I'm inclined to, absolutely.
So,
I'm lost still, because does he, there's the dream where he gives his brother the envelope.
It's a dream.
That's a dream. So he doesn't actually... I mean, no. At that point, I waited the whole time to not be on his side if he did anything with that envelope. It's not what he does with the envelope. It's what he does with the grade. You're exactly. wrong. It's not the exactly. envelope.
Well,
it's
that has everything to do with the envelope. Yes, because what happens at the end, he needs money.
Yeah.
He needs money at the end. So he changes the grade. And the second he does that...
The tornado.
Which is brilliant.
Yeah.
Not just the tornado. The phone call.
Uh-huh.
Who cares about the tornado? Because he's been so self...
Yeah,
he's been insulated by his own worries about himself.
Yeah,
you realize that? I mean, like mm-hmm. his, the whole thing is him. Just the only thing he cares about in the least bit, of any of the other characters at all, is his son doing the bar mitzvah,
mm-hmm.
and the son having finished the bar mitzvah. The only person that the tornado seems to be directly doing anything to is his son. So, like, all the actions that anyone does adversely, where they claim. They've done nothing. Then anything they actually did wrong suddenly comes back to bite them in the end, or not, you know?
Yeah.
You don't know, because it ends like that.
It's very nihilistic. Shit just happens.
Super nihilistic. And not just that, but I felt like, instead of it just being nihilism, it's like, you know what? If you're going to be a member of this faith or any faith, and you live that way, like, you know, I think it really had a interesting idea about the idea of God. Like, you, whatever faith you're part of, you 100% believe, if you're part of any faith, that
it's like that new whatchamacallit, that new Dan Brown book about what is it, the idea is becoming real the more people think about it, or whatever.
Dan Brown is an idiot.
Yeah.
but you know, I mean, in any anything works the same way.
Works for you if you work for
it. You forget about God until something bad happens. You beg God for, please save me. I'll never do something again. You get better. Everything's great. And you're like, God's not looking.
What have you done for me lately?
And then what never happens is, wham, suddenly he's like, oh yeah? Boom!
Little rat.
Yeah.
Are you like a little rat?
And it was, I thought it was great. I don't know. It's just, it was, for how it is about nothing, and it's shot in Minnesota, and it's shot in suburbs, mm-hmm. and it's shot in a lot of inside...
1967, Seth and I saw. Yeah. Seth and I caught the calendar. They always do that with their movies. Yeah. They, you have to look real hard, but they'll give you the date.
So then they shoot it inside a bunch of offices, uh-huh. and yet, after all that, the cinematography is amazing, and, okay. and it's stylistically amazing for what it's really is. Good. It's really incredible. And the way they throw in the comedy with the character who his wife is leaving him for mm-hmm. was amazing. I sat with Blaine and Ryan, and we laughed so hard when the guy, he walks in the house the first time, uh-huh. and he goes, I brought you this wine. And he explains what he needs to do with the wine. He needs to pop the cork.
Let it breathe.
10 minutes. For 10 minutes. 10 minutes. You need to let it breathe. And he's like in this guy's space the whole uh-huh. time, and he forces him to hug him. He overwhelms him into not being
He keeps
being
the
upset.
Door open, too. That's what pissed me off the most. He opens the guy's door, and then walks into his house and just keeps the door open
but,
the whole time.
But you notice with him... Here's the funny thing. This guy, something I've only realized after I wrote the first review is, so the main guy, by the way, was fantastic. He was perfect for that role. Like I don't want to like say it in a Jewish way, but like he was perfect for that Jewish kind of like character who's like, he really is kind of nebbishy and everything like that, but he was a fantastic actor. He doesn't learn from the lesson of the guy who was basically... in a realm of adultery with his wife and who is driving to golf one day and who was crapped all over him mm-hmm. and ends up, you know, getting snuffed.
Yeah.
He doesn't learn from that. He sees it happen to someone else. Not only does he not learn from it, he pays for the guy's funeral, like you said. So he continues on his cycle of woe is me, woe is me, woe is me, and reacting to things that happen in everyone's life that are not, you know, they're not cataclysmic. They're basic everyday things. Until the point where he finally does have a chance to do some sort of really kind of ethically wrong thing, and that's when the hammer comes down.
Yep.
And I don't know, for it being a movie really about nothing, I think that's brilliant. Like, that it all works out that way. It ends up kind of not being about nothing. It's got about some major themes.
No, it's definitely playing with all those themes, and it's great. I mean, I wonder how much more, like if I really knew anything about like the Jewish faith and like traditions and stuff, if I would get a lot more stuff that's going on in the movie. I'm sure there's a handful.
One thing I was
going to ask you, I almost made a note about this. Seth and I noticed this a couple times when they're eating and twice, like as his family, they've got their glasses and they're filled with like, it just looks like the glasses with ice and nothing in them. What was that all about? Does that mean anything? Or is that just a weird thing that we both noticed that's in the movie?
That's
Do you remember?
Something you both, I don't remember that.
It's just like lots of ice in glasses, and they're eating, you know, their soup or whatever in that one scene. And then earlier, it's all four of them, and it's just like, what's with all the ice? I think it doesn't make any sense.
Here's another thing I thought was interesting. So if you're going to, I think their point was, I mean, here's the thing. They base it a lot on their experiences because they both grew up in Minnesota. You know, they're Jewish. Yada yada.
Okay.
And it's set in the time when they would have been about the age of the sun.
Okay.
And so they said they based a lot on that, on their experiences with that. So being Jewish is something so different than other faiths because it's kind of counted as an ethnicity, even though it's not. It's a cultural identity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something you can choose to do. You can convert to it, but the most Orthodox people won't accept you. Because you've converted to it. It has to follow a lineage.
A maternal lineage.
That has nothing to do with ethnicity.
Yeah.
So, the idea that he has lived outside it, and he's the one who freaks out about these occurrences happening to him, he does... Here's the thing about the Jewish identity, is that they almost gladly take the idea that they must bear more hardships than any other people.
Being the
chosen tribe, and having rejected, you know, well, the Christian viewpoint is having rejected the Savior, they continue to bear hardships. Their idea is God, just because you know, because he loves them so much, gives them even more tests to go through.
Okay, yeah.
Which plays
to the theme of this movie, all these tests
exactly,
he's going through.
But the thing
right?
is this.
That's just part of life.
He asks all the rabbis, all the people they ask, they very cheerfully tell him, oh yeah, we go through lots of hardships. They're all cheerful. You notice how cheerful they are?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, that's
part of
right.
the game.
That's part of the thing.
It's part of life.
I can't give you any answers. Sorry. And they're really happy to tell him that. And that infuriates him even more, frustrates him even more. So it's like, I think it was almost like, it was kind of made, you know, for Jews, I almost want to say, because you can't not identify with it. And what's interesting is, after we do finish our thing here, I want to talk about the next movie.
Okay.
I want to do a little trifecta, a Jewfecta, if you will.
Okay.
Did the informant have Jews in it? I don't know.
It was made by one, maybe?
It was made by one. So
he was almost a baseball player, Soderbergh.
Yeah, sure.
No, he was. I think I read his bio.
So
that'd be cool.
It'll be a little Jewfecta. Because
like
the next movie
director and
has a similar theme, but to more devastating effects.
Okay.
So I think the idea beyond what I already said was...
If you
don't want to identify with it already, or you want to casually identify with it, then don't complain about the things that come along with it, because it's unique to have the hardships they do. But what's funny is, I mean, if you think about it,
it's part of
any,
life.
Any ethnicity has
that's
a great
all
deal
that's
of
all artificial.
Yeah, it is all artificial. It is all artificial.
And I think that's the. I think that's maybe. I mean, I was kind of kidding when I said it was a little anti-Semitic, but I think that's maybe the point. Is that all this Jew stuff that's going on in the movie? Is, I mean, it is what it is. It's, you know, if that, like I said, it's part of his cultural identity, and it seems almost everyone, with the exception maybe of the neighbor, identifies themselves with that. I couldn't figure out Adam Arkin if he was Jewish or not.
Jewish, yeah.
But I mean, like the guy that was going to give him tenure
he's Jewish because he asked him if the guy had told him about the goy's teeth.
Yeah, but I thought he might have just said that.
No.
As part of the. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, and Adam Arkin is Jewish.
So, yeah. Well. I mean,
I think everyone in the movie is Jewish.
but the whole point was that in the end, it was just like, yeah, life has problems. You learn to deal with them. Now, if you turn to a faith and that helps you, that's one thing. But if you, like you said, if you're using it with sort of an ulterior motive,
yeah.
And you haven't learned, you know, I mean, what is it? It's the guy on his roof in the flood praying to God and turning away the helicopter and the boat and all that,
yeah.
Right? You know, and it's
Well,
I sent you a helicopter. I sent you a boat. You know, I mean. It's like in life you have to live your life. You're the only one that's going to live your own life and solve your own problems.
Here's the thing I thought was great about it was that in picking for it to be just 100% Jewish all the way across, it makes it more universal because it is, it's the same experience that I think I wrote in my review that a Lutheran somewhere would have was that is the same thing. You beg God for something in times of hardship. When the hardship passes, you kind of put God on the back burner again.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was like, you know, if you're going to be serious about this faith, then, you know, you're going to pay for it. You're going to pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not taking that.
Did it make you go to church more when she saw it?
It didn't. But I, you know, not to get into this too much, but we haven't found a church we really like that much. We had a kid. It's hard to get everything ready and going.
Yeah,
so.
Life happens.
When he's a little bit older, I would like to find a church we can go to full time. So, part three, the Jewfecta.
Part three.
Oh, wait, but first, give it a grade.
Give it a grade. I'm going to give it a four.
I'll give it a four.
It
might be
higher
than I gave it at the time. But I, the more I've thought about it, the more I enjoyed it.
No, yeah, definitely.
Okay, so part three, the Jewfecta, which I don't think you've seen, but an early David Mamet film, maybe his second film, called
Homicide. With I've seen it. I love the Mamet.
It just came out on a Criterion Collection, so I got
Blu-ray
that.
Blu-ray or just DVD?
Just DVD. Oh, it's on Blu-ray also. But
Yojimbo on Blu-ray in May.
Yeah, are you psyched?
I am.
You can see that crisp black and white with the crackles in it.
I know.
Clear.
I don't. I don't imagine it will look that great. I mean, it'll look good as Kurosawa and all, but I mean, it's like they didn't have that much money back in the day. You know, it's post World War II.
Yeah. So, Homicide is
Fat Tony. And Bill May.
Yeah, but it's 100% the question of, you know, it got almost kind of boring when it talked about this, when it got more into this, about
yeah,
this
did.
Guy's cultural thing.
It did.
But I thought that made it a stronger film because it became more interesting. And the con that was pulled on him by his people was even more devastating.
Oh, yeah.
Because they, you know...
It's been a long time since I've seen it, so maybe do a little plot review.
Okay,
so as you're saying things, I'm kind of remembering
it's
the general...
like this. So, Montaigne, who has no business playing a Jew, is a guy named somebody Gold. He's a Jew in the movie. Me and Ryan are watching it and making fun, basically doing the Fat Tony voice the whole time, and like, you know, same thing. When are we gonna go to a shul? You know, we gotta get over to shul. I don't know, but I think you liked it too. But and also a very young Ving Rhames with hair.
Yeah, he's in it.
Yep. And Bill Macy, of course. You know, yeah, we talked about that. Rebecca Pigeon, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're not a fan of the Pigeon.
I hate the Pigeon.
I don't think you're supposed to like her in any of those movies.
So he and Macy are a couple of tough Chicago cops, or whatever they are.
I think, is it?
It's not New York. Yeah, it's not New York. They're dealing with a case with an African-American gentleman who is a violent, dangerous criminal trying to leave the country. They're trying to find him. They lose him in the opening thing where there's a violent shootout inside a building. The SWAT comes in, busts it open. This guy ends up escaping through a secret passageway out of his house up onto a rooftop, escapes into the night. They have a connection to his cousin, so they think they can get him through there. So they go and bust the cousin. On the way back, the FBI is involved, and the FBI is questioning their tactics. And a black FBI member calls Gold a stupid kike. And he gets upset, but Macy goes livid. Mm-hmm. You know, Macy's he's Irish. His name's Tom Sullivan or something. Yeah. That's his name. And he's like, he wants to fight the guy. He rips off his jacket.
It's one of those weird things maybe where like if you're with somebody and somebody insults your friend, then it's like if you're the one being insulted, you kind of have to like...
No, he's not insulted.
But you have to be... It's almost like, you know, it's like... I've had to deal with this, whatever, I blow it off, I'm better than you. But, like, as the friend, you kind of need to be, like, the one that will, like, get in a fight about it. Because you can't get in a fight about it, the friend has to. It's weird, but I think I get that, like, you know, like, if I was with someone and someone said something like that, then I would be pissed. But if someone made, you know, fun of my ethnicity, which is nothing, and they said, hey, you crowd,
hey, you mutt
thing that...
Hey, you European.
Hey, you fat cat that's the problem with all the world, greedy capitalist. Then I'd be like, that's right.
So he's kind of bummed about that, but it doesn't really affect him because it's a name to him.
Yeah.
That's what it is. So anyway...
It's hurtful, though. It's
on wrong. On the way to the big bust of the cousin, they kind of inadvertently slam on the brakes and stop in front of a murder that had happened, which is some Jewish woman in a shop had been killed. There's a bunch of people outside. A couple of kids claim out front that she got killed because she had some treasure downstairs.
Oh, and treasure.
They kind of ignore her, you know, and they ignore the kids. And he gets involved. When the commanding officer gets there, the guy's like, it's your case, man. You were the highest ranking person who came to it. It's your case. And he doesn't want it. He wants to get the big thing.
Yeah.
Go on. It becomes interesting because... The case he gets involved with a dead woman becomes all about being Jewish. The person whose mother it was who worked at the shop asks for him to be involved with it because he's Jewish. Like everyone involved is Jewish, and he begins to slowly think and realize there's some sort of Jewish conspiracy going on. He goes downstairs into the shop eventually and finds an old invoice for a bunch of Tommy guns and a picture of the woman in the 40s with the Tommy guns, which is the time when the war for the homestead was happening. After they had given the Jews Israel, there was a pretty massive war with Palestine in there, mm-hmm. Because Palestine didn't accept it. So
they do now, though, right?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay. They bend over backwards for the Jews.
Absolutely.
I didn't know if you knew that.
No.
So his reluctance, you know, becomes kind of like, he becomes really curious about it, and he investigates and really gets wrapped up in this conspiracy thing, and then Ricky Jay pops in. Like
Ricky Jay!
The coolest
Did you guys
thing is,
high-five when Ricky Jay
No, I was
in?
Like, oh, Ricky Jay, though. Uh-huh.
Did he get killed in a way that seemed unfair?
No, Ricky Jay didn't die in this one.
Okay.
But then it turns out the conspiracy kind of seems to be true. At the same time, his cop buddies are like, look, we know the captain told you got to be working on this thing, and there was some pull downtown, you got to be doing this, but we need you on this thing. We need you to get the passport to convince, we got to convince the mother about the black guy getting out. Mm-hmm. you know, he's
the original case name,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and he's the negotiator of the whole group. So like, we need you there, and he ends up talking the mother into it, and she's like, all right, I'll do this. You know, I'll turn my son in if you're there, because he's like, you know, if it's not us, the FBI are just going to kill him. You know, anyway. He gets so wrapped up that he kind of forgets about that, and bad things happen. A long con is pulled.
Nice.
And at the end of it, so he's gone from not identifying with his faith whatsoever to being 100% convinced by these people how much he has needed to fight for his homeland. He starts to believe in something other than trying to do the cop thing. Like, all he ever wanted to do was
live his life.
Well, no, he wanted to be a good cop, get some accolades. You know, and he didn't identify with it at all. So he kind of gets browbeaten into identifying with being Jewish, and ends up being utterly backstabbed and screwed on that. And at the end of the movie, he's sitting there with this like devastated look on his face, like, I've got nothing. Because what's funny is like the biggest thing that ends up turning up is you almost think maybe it was all in his mind, because a piece of evidence that leads him toward everything gets revealed to him that it was nothing, and that it had nothing to do with anything he learned about. Mm. And he sits there devastated. People he loved and cared for are dead. Both cases went to crap. It's dramatically, it was really hefty the dialogue was Mammoth to a fault. Like, it was more Mammoth than any other Mammoth.
Yeah.
To a fault, because a bunch of actors who I'd never seen before were just punching out his rat-a-tat dialogue, and a lot of times it was like robots. It was like, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, and they turn and walk out the door like all stiff. And, you know, Montaigne can handle it. He's done it before. He did it in House of Games, his first movie. Macy, of course, is built for it.
Yeah.
And Ving Rhames, like, seemed to ignore it. Like, I bet Mammoth was like, no, no, say it this way. And he was like, what? He's like, never mind. Do it however you want, you know? I have a feeling that's
Ving Rhames is like, you know, I was in that final episode of The Equalizer, right? Yeah.
Anyway, it wasn't quite what I expected. But when it ended up having the con in it, I felt like a flood of joy. Like, it was like, oh, the con.
This is the Mammoth. This is just what I wanted.
And then it ends up just being like, it was just kind of brutal at the end.
But that's a Mammoth thing. It's the play to the man's ego.
For sure.
Just like with Red Belt. Play to the guy's ego, long con. But with Red Belt, you get that second punch.
He does the thing that's rad to me, which is like, the person who gets crapped on all movie was like, you know what, though? I'm not going to take it anymore.
No, I'm done with this.
Stands up and
finishes
it for everybody.
We're going to take care of you now. Good stuff.
So,
what's he doing next?
Mammoth? I don't know. Let's see what Mammoth's doing.
Some good flavor from the Mammoth Man. Yeah, I know.
Oh, he's doing the sequel to The Last Airbender. No, I don't know.
Last Airbender. That would be interesting. I still think that the Kenneth Branagh Thor is going to be kind of cool, maybe.
Looks like he's got...
even though I don't care at all about Thor.
My phone's going off.
Oh, it's you.
He's got a bunch of plays that came out this last year. He directed The Diary of Anne Frank, apparently. It's coming out this year.
Oh, that'll be interesting. Okay, well, yeah. So, that was a big, long one. A lot of discussion, a lot of material. Like I said, you can check us on iTunes, Futile Podcast. You can rate us and give us reviews and all that nifty stuff. Let us know. Send us an email, futilepodcast@gmail.com. The apathy of the internet is replete, though. It's like hitting your head against a brick wall. Though, I gotta wonder, it seems like we get feeds every day when I check the stats on WordPress, and I don't know if that's repeat people or new people for each time. Like, if that's a new person getting the feed, basically subscribing or just getting the podcast through the feed, then we've got like a couple thousand people, which, I mean, I'm fine with. It would just be nice to get an email or two from somebody to know that there's like somebody that consistently maybe finds this interesting or entertaining, or start a dialogue with other people. I don't know, maybe we offended a lot of people with all the Jewish assertions that were in this one. They're gonna set fire to our homes.
Just
me.
The Instro Podcast.
Oh boy. No, don't hurt me.
There was a part where he's up on the roof and he opens one of those.
Is this Ryan or you?
Me.
Okay, nice.
There was pigeon feed, and I said, "I guess that's what they paid her in."
Oh boy.
And Ryan was like, "What?" Because I think he was really high.
And then did you repeat it?
No,
it deserved repeating.
I just kept going.